Good morning. My name is Keegan Rasko, and I'd like to welcome you to Life Downstream. Life Downstream is a radio show where I, a high school English student, and my high school English teacher, Mr. Andrew Morgan, go to interesting people from around the community and talk to them about their life experiences and how those life experiences allowed them to learn outside of a classroom. For this week, our studio guest is Betsy Johnson. She's coming to fill out the rest of her interview from about 3 weeks ago. And with that, I'll pass it over to Mr. Morgan.
I wanted to ask a little bit about how you got into aviation. And I know you've kind of filled a couple different roles prior to going into politics. You've been a commercial pilot. You were the owner, founder of Transwestern Helicopter. Tell us a little bit about your interest in that. How did you get involved in that?
My father thought both my sister and I, there were only two of us, she's a little bit younger than I am, that we ought to know how to do all sorts of things and experience all sorts of things. He had not been well during some of our early childhood and was put on an experimental protocol of drugs to deal with, in its simplest form, rheumatoid arthritis that was extremely painful for him. And he ended up taking an experimental protocol of drugs, and his physician basically said to him, this is going to fix you or it's going to kill you. And it fixed him. And it fixed him with such an aggressive outlook on life. He was not in pain. He was better. And so all of a sudden, we were doing all sorts of things. We went down to the mill and rolled logs in the pond. We learned to shoot. We learned to fly. We learned to ride. We learned to do all sorts of kind of atypical things. I used to joke it was because he was disappointed that he didn't have boys and he had to make the best he could out of two girls. But we went everywhere, and Sam was so engaged in our lives and pushing us to do more and more and more. Sam had had a pilot's license and thought that we ought to learn how to fly, and so both of us learned how to fly in Redmond. Our instructor was also our math teacher, Larry Myers. Bless his dear sweetheart. In the summer, as many people in Redmond did, he participated in firefighting. And he was flying one of Cal Butler's airplanes back from a fire. And I don't know how many people they had on, 17, 13, 14, I forget how many, but a lot of people. And they failed to clear the top of a ridge and crashed. And all of these people were killed, including Larry Myers. It was catastrophic for Redmond because everybody knew somebody that had been in that airplane. And so we learned to fly, and but both of us took it very, very seriously. My mother wanted both of us to know how to do something before, as she thought about it, we ran off and joined the circus, which was flying. My sister went to nursing school and was an intensive care unit nurse at Emmanuel Hospital. And then she went on to teach aerobatics and fly a jet for a bank and taught aerobatics in a school called All Attitude Aviation. And I became friends with a guy who had been a naval aviator, a helicopter pilot. And I already flew airplanes, but he said, come on out here and I want to show you how to do this. And for me, I joke about it. It was like heroin, you know, first shot's free. And I was,
what's the allure? What for people that don't fly or aren't into, you know, this, what's the draw?
It is as close to a magic carpet as you can let your imagination allow you to believe. It was tremendously interesting. And we started out principally as a maintenance facility. We were going to take care of other people's helicopters. And at that point, Mount St. Helens was starting to rumble. I flew one of the first reporting jobs from the mountain. We landed in a parking lot that is now particulate somewhere scattered out over Montana. And my company set all the original seismometers up at the mountain. I remember vividly, we were watching with interest because we'd been involved with the U.S. Geological Survey and others. And I remember vividly the morning the mountain erupted. I was in Redmond. I was having breakfast with my parents. And our chief mechanic called and said the mountain just went. I got in a car and drove like a bat out of hell back over here. If we'd had 1,000 helicopters on the ramp, and I'm not exaggerating, they'd all gone to work. Everything we had was flying. I flew that day, and we said to the scientists, how should we treat the surface? if we have to land? And they said, well, it's 300 feet of boiling mud. You figure out how you treat the surface. Most of the pictures of the logs coming down the Tootle were taken from our helicopters.
Oh, wow.
One of my favorite pictures is a very famous picture of Harry Truman, the guy that lived up at the lodge at the lake. And the news people were all watching him very closely because people were trying to urge him to leave the mountain. And we got called the night before the mountain blew up, because it blew up at 8:23 in the morning. And the message we got was, Harry Truman wants to leave. God, we dispatched helicopters and roared up there. This was going to be the biggest news story of the planet. Harry Truman was abandoning the lodge. And we got up there, and Mr. Truman, who was given to taking the occasional medicinal drink, was already well underway and was swearing at the news people and swearing at us. And they had to keep covering up the microphones because of the colorful language. And at the very end, one of the pictures is him holding up a drink. And that was the last picture that was taken of Harry Truman.
Facing the mountain or
facing,
like,
the helicopter.
Oh, okay.
And as the helicopters all flew away without having him on board.
Oh, really?
And okay. The next morning he was incinerated when the mountain blew up. There were amazing stories from the mountain. We had the principal photographer for Time magazine sleeping in our hangar because he couldn't find a hotel room. And we were up there every day.
So how much advance notice did your company have, and did you have, knowing that, okay, this is coming?
Weeks. They were well aware. The U.S. Geological Survey was well aware of what was going on, and they had all these seismometers that were monitoring the activity. So in the grossest sense, they knew it was going to go.
Okay.
They didn't know when.
Yeah.
And so had we had any notice of the exact moment it was going to go? Absolutely not.
Hmm.
And there were all kinds of stories out of the mountain, all the different crews that worked up there, the different companies, the National Guard guys. It was kind of a symphony of aircraft in and out of the crater. And I've landed in the crater a number of times. One of the photographs that hangs in my office in Scappoose was deemed one of Life magazine's photo of the decade, and it's one of our helicopters on the lava dome. We used to be able to fly, I haven't been up there in years, but we used to be able to fly all around the lava dome and watch it like this great big chocolate cookie kind of come up. And now eventually that lava dome will be the new top of the mountain.
Mm.
But we had some good times up there, and crews all flew there for a long, long time.
Had you done that type of flying before, like in these really, you know, challenging environments and difficult to land, or was this really the first kind of...
Oh, make no mistake. There is nothing as challenging as flying in an active volcano.
Yeah.
I remember one time I was going to drive across the Cascades to have Christmas with my parents, and my mother said to me, oh, it's so dangerous, and you've got to be careful, and it could be snowing, and it might be slippery. And my response to her was, Mother, I work in an active volcano. I think I can probably stumble across government camp. Nothing prepared us for that. And we pioneered ways in tearing up equipment.
Hmm.
There are parts of a helicopter called compressor halves that are supposed to last for thousands of hours of flying time. We were chewing them up in 125 hours.
Wow.
The leading edge on rotor blades, our ships ended up having special tape that Bell Helicopter Textron developed to put on the leading edges of airfoils when they were flying in corrosive or challenging environments. And we were ripping up rotor blades, the erosion of all the particulate in the air. We ripped up helicopters, we ripped up rotor blades, and it was just the wear and tear in that environment.
Hmm.
You know, sometimes we made money, not so much when you're tearing up rotor blades that are multiple thousands of dollars a piece.
So that was really just a couple years into Transwestern's mm-hmm. history, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of at the beginning
of
its...
Yeah, very much
so. So did you feel like after St. Helens, I don't know, did you ever think, like, we can handle anything? We've made it through the St. Helens ordeal, like, jobs that come up with Transwestern, we got this. We understand what we're doing.
Yes and no. No good pilot ever takes a "we got this" attitude towards a job. Safety is always number one. Every job needs to be treated differently for the safe aspects about that. So I wouldn't characterize it the way you characterized it, but I would characterize it as saying we collectively, all the pilots that worked for the company, including me, we will never do anything this exciting again. I mean, the phone rang and it would be a volcanologist from France. We had Japanese volcanologists. I look at the mountain now and I think we were part of putting that back together again when all of the infrastructure blew up. We certainly recorded an important part of history from cameras on our machines. Now, the pictures and the cameras belong to news people and stuff like that. But we ended up with a rich archive of unique one-off photographs of an important part of Washington and Oregon, the region's history. And it was exciting. It was challenging. It was terrifying. It was enervating. It's an experience that not very many people have had, and I am thankful for it. I am appreciative that all of our guys came out okay. I mean, working in that environment, it could have been different.
So I'm curious, just bringing it back to your father, you used the word, you said Sam instead of dad or my father.
My sister and I always called him Sam. I don't ever remember calling him anything other than Sam.
Interesting.
Yeah.
See, I mean, my dad's name is Sam, and I still go by Dad.
We always called Sam Sam.
Interesting.
And people would say, you know, is that a stepfather or? You know, mm-hmm. We always called him Sam, and I called my mother Hub, as in Hubbard. Hubbard. So it was Hub and Sam always.
I have to ask you about just, you know, kind of lessons learned and things you've kind of noticed over the years since you've been involved in politics. Since you started serving in 2000, right? Mm-hmm. You were in the House of Reps in 2000, State House of Reps, and then 2005 you were elected to State Senate.
No, that's not right.
Oh,
yes, I was appointed.
Appointed, ah,
because
okay.
What happened was I had... an interesting convergence of things happened that allowed me to run for the House. I always knew I was going to do that. Sam had, as I said, been a reluctant candidate. He was part of a group of businessmen that were trying to recruit candidates to run for what was then an open Senate seat and an open House seat together in Central Oregon. So they had recruited a wonderful candidate for the Senate, a guy named Gordon McKay, now gone. And they couldn't find a House person. So these group of Sam's colleagues said, well, we're not going to let this go by default. So you go over there and be the sacrificial lamb and sign up for the candidacy. Sam was a kind of shy person, considering what an outgoing political figure he ended up being. He was inherently kind of shy.
Did that surprise you that he became that over time in that role?
I was young enough that I didn't know it at the time. But yes, as he went through his legislative career. And so the conventional wisdom was Gordon McKay couldn't lose and Sam couldn't win. Well, Sam won and went on to win seven more times. And it was a different legislature then. Sam was appointed by a Democrat speaker, Phil Lang, to chair a very significant committee. Sam was a Republican, a moderate Republican. Yeah. That kind of bipartisanship collaborative partisanship was, I think, more characteristic of, this was during the McCall days, of that political time. These guys could have principal debates on the floor, and then they'd all go down to a nasty old bar that's since burned down called the Marion Motor Hotel. And most of them lived at the Marion Motor Hotel, and they'd all go down to this grotty little bar down there, and they liked each other. They drank together. They told stories together. And it was out of that era that came the bottle bill, Oregon's land use architecture, the beach bill. These guys liked each other. And that kind of collegial absence of this biting, bitter, vitriolic partisanship characterized a different kind of legislature. But going back to my run, I always knew I was going to run. And I had just come off a corporate board that did not allow partisan participation. And Jackie, the wonderful state representative who represented this area, Jackie Taylor, was stopped from running again. So the seat was empty. And I put my hat in and won. And so then I was subsequently elected to three terms. 10 days into my third term, the then Senator Joan Dukes was appointed to a remunerative position. She was appointed by the governor to the Northwest Power Planning Council. And you couldn't be in the legislature and on what was then the Northwest Power Planning Council. And so Senator Dukes resigned. And then I was unanimously appointed by five sets of county commissioners to take her seat. And it was really daunting because it was done over the telephone, and all of the county commissioners voted individually. In the Columbia County Courthouse, listening to them call out my name one after another, and it was unanimous, was really humbling.
Wow.
And then I started representing the whole district in 2005 and have subsequently then earned election past that, the most recently in November. And I was very honored to win by a large margin. I love what I do. I hope it shows. And so that brings us current.
Some things over the years that you kind of mentioned that you feel like, you know, there's been this kind of shift, that collegiate sort of feel, you know, is not as present. Are there other kind of takeaways you've noticed? I mean, it's been 19 years, right, since you've been serving in public office now.
Well, I've always been a budget writer. I was appointed to Ways and Means in my freshman session. And it was funny because I called my mother and I said, God, I got appointed to full Ways and Means in my freshman year. And she said to me, well, your father had to wait three terms before he got appointed. So what's up with you getting this? And I thought, thanks, mother, for that big resounding. But I have been a budget writer since I first arrived. So I deal less with policy than I do with budget. There are two tracks in the Oregon legislature. One of them is the policy, and those are the committees where changes to the law are debated and testimony is heard and people can come and present the pro and con on a proposed change or creation of law. And then there's the budget track that works with the state agencies to have balanced budgets and performance within their budget specifications. And so I have always been a budget guy.
What's the allure in that for you?
Follow the money.
Could you talk a little bit about what it's like to try to create consensus among fellow lawmakers? I have this image of Sam's kind of generation in mind, and I'm sure there were those predispositions present then, right? People were representing constituencies that, you know, were leaning in this direction or that direction or this industry or that industry. How was it that they were able to table that or, you know, kind of work with that and still get together for a beer? And it's just fascinating to me that
I think they had more time together that was not intense political time. That's the first thing. The second thing was that the legislature was not so infested with special interests. That's not to say that they weren't there, but not as aggressively so. Money was not as big a deal. Sam told me one time, I don't remember exactly, it was either 7,500 or 12,500, that he had never, I think it was 7,500, that he had never spent more than that on a race. Wow. Now you have legislative races that cost over $1 million for a job that pays the functional equivalent of the swing shift at Burger King. And for some people, I think they view the stakes as being higher. We have lived through the spotted owl crisis that saw the timber industry decimated, and I think some of those folks feel very defensive and like they're rocked back on their hind legs, worried about when's the next spotted owl going to finish off what's left of the timber industry. I don't know what else is causal. I think perhaps Keegan and I were talking about this before that we started the show, and that is the kind of corrosive degeneration of our institutions. The coarseness of the debate, the partisan polarization, the the striking down of those things that were always considered to be sort of bedrocks, the perception that the courts may not be equitable, the perception that one man, one vote, or one person, one vote, doesn't count anymore, the intrusion of social media that is not always factual and not always able to be authenticated. So there's a lot of stuff that's different than a kinder, gentler Oregon of 50 years ago.
I'm curious, so your father was a Republican, that's well known, and you're a Democrat, so what was that? What was that for you when you decided which party you were going to go with?
There probably isn't a dime's worth of difference between my politics and Sam's. Mm-hmm. And for me, it turned on a very narrow issue. I first started registered as a Republican. And the thing that ended up changing my registration was being very harshly criticized by the Republican Party for the fact that I was adamantly pro-choice. Mm-hmm. And so a pretty narrow issue, but I couldn't stay in good conscience registered as a Republican when my views on a woman's right to reproductive choices differed so substantially from the R's.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting point, because not a lot of people think of, you know, my dad's a Democrat. Obviously, I'm stepping out of myself here, but my dad's a Democrat. I have to be a Democrat. My mom's a Republican. I need to be a Republican. So I think it's really interesting that we think about our political tendencies as not being represented by a party, but our political tendencies being chosen as a result of where we're sitting.
Oh, I'm sure you're right. Yeah. I'm sure you're right, because basically when I registered to vote, it was not how did you register, it was did you register.
Yeah.
But I would sit particularly with my mother and go over the ballot measures, and my mother was an intense student and taught me sort of the intellectual rigor of try to do both sides and not just take what you read in the paper or hear from your friends as dicta. But I think that there is a tendency to register as you are affiliated in your family affiliations. The one thing that has changed that, and it was amazing to me, is, I believe, an awakening among sectors of the populace in Oregon right now, heretofore unengaged in politics. Timber Unity was drawn together by the very social media that I was just a moment ago critical of, but that was a completely authentic, organic, they weren't organized by lobbyists or outside special interests. They found themselves. And I think that there is a set of those Timber Unity folks who may have reliably voted Democratic because they believed that the Democrats were for the working guy. And all of a sudden, when they felt, particularly like down at WANA, that their jobs were in jeopardy by virtue of Democrat bills, I think that there was an awakening saying we're going to be much more politically involved. Now, how they break Republican, Democrat, Independent, I don't know. But I can tell you that I have heard from knowledgeable people that the independent or non-affiliated registration has gone through the ceiling in Oregon.
Hmm. It's really interesting to me. Seeing the way that those policies move around is really, it's amazing to me, because Oregon has been reliably Democrat forever. And it seems interesting that we can finally start to find ourselves politically.
Well, I think that there are going to be many more unaffiliated people. And as your listeners undoubtedly know, you've got Democrats, Republicans, independents with a capital I.
Yeah.
There is an independent party, an independent little I, which is functionally non-affiliated. And I think calling that the independent party, capital I, independent party, was brilliant because people go down to register.
There's crossover,
people go down to register and say, a pox on all of them. I want to register independent. And boom, they're registered capital I independent.
Interesting.
What they really wanted to register was non-affiliated independent. Mm-hmm. But I think there will be a growth of non-partisan voters. Now, I could be proven absolutely wrong as we get into the election season. So I don't know. I could be wrong. I'm giving you the gospel according to Betsy on, you know, some evening in Astoria doing this radio show. I could be proven absolutely wrong.
You know, with so much feeling like it's shifting and, you know, feeling like, oh, the old ways of approaching this maybe don't apply as much anymore. Is that an exciting political landscape for you to be a part of, or is it unnerving?
Yes.
Yes to both.
Yes to both. Lots of things in our country are exhilarating and terrifying as the old norms are beginning to collapse or modify or not exist the way that they did in your childhood or mm-hmm. mine. I am clearly the oldest person in this room, and so I represent, I still carry a flip phone. That's how much of a dinosaur I am. It's Keegan's generation that will reap the whirlwind of so many of these changes now. Mm. And frankly, if I were a high schooler right at this moment, I think I would be overwhelmed by the rapidity of how information moves, what my options and choices are, what I would want to do with the rest of my life. The old norms are disintegrating right in front of us. I will be dead before they completely fall.
Before the dust settles, yeah.
Keegan's going to be right in the middle of it.
So one last question. If you, where has been the peak, if you've seen it, of your life? Is it running around in the backyard of your old house, or is it flying above Mount Everest, or is it being representing District 16?
Oh, Keegan, that's a question I can't answer. the story is still unfolding, and I hope I'm around to participate in it for a little bit longer. Each particular aspect of my life had some highs and some lows. It's difficult to begin to tease out what matters the most. I married my wonderful husband when he worked for the helicopter company. I actually fired him, and then he came back and went to workforce again, and then I married him. But it is hard to tease it all out. I have lived, in my own opinion, a wonderful life. I had a terrific family. I have a terrific marriage. I am able to do meaningful and important work that I get up every morning ready to go at. And people are going to disagree with me, but I believe I can offer a rational explanation for everything that I do, the votes I cast. Somebody asked me a question not unlike this the other night. In the greater scheme of things, the fact that I helped a little kid get adopted in time to start school with his contemporaries and his peers, instead of coming into a new school 2 weeks later. Did the earth move because of that? No. Did it move for that kid? You're damn right it did.
Mm-hmm. Senator Betsy Johnson, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us today. Is there anything folks should be aware of in the next couple weeks? Anything you want to plug? Something that's happening in your world that, you know, people can take a look at or come out and see you speak at?
There is so much to plug. The good news is that I am privileged to represent communities where community matters. And so there are fundraisers for good causes in just about every community. I will be the MC and the money ask for the Liberty Theater's second great gala on November the 16th. I try to be out in the community a lot. So I guess what I would recommend to folks is keep your eye on the paper. There are innumerable good causes to support. Any given weekend in the places I represent, there are Oregonians coming together to do for and help others. And I try to lend my support to those kind of events. I think they're incredibly important.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
Thanks. So this is the portion of the show where I offer my student perspective on our in-studio guest today. And one of the things that I think Betsy really drove home in this interview is the necessity of cooperation. We need to cooperate in order to tackle the biggest problems facing our community. How could we ever hope to solve an issue such as climate change if we can't even come across the aisle to talk about how our days went? And I think that this is most obvious on social media. How many of us in this audience have had a fight over some political issue over a social media platform? And because of this, I think my generation is coming to terms very quickly with the fact that we don't need to have an argument in order to have an opinion. The key to persuasion is demonstrating that your point is right and just. And if your point in actuality isn't right nor just, people will figure that out on their own. Thanks for tuning in, and if you want to hear this entire interview, you can go to KMUN's website, and under the podcast, go to Life Downstream and listen to part 1 and part 2.